global business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
From Bloomberg World Headquarters, I'm Charlie Pellett. The Dow, the S&P, NASDAQ all advancing. The Russell 2000 also trading at a record. This update is brought to you by Bentley University. What do developing apps at Facebook and analyzing data at Biogen have in common? An MBA from Bentley University, where you will explore innovation and leadership because business is everywhere. Prepare here. Dow Jones Industrial Average holding above 19,000 now, 19,012. It is up 0.3%, gaining 55 points. Stocks are extending their post-election rally. The S&P 500 index up 3 points to 2201, up 0.1%. NASDAQ is up 11, a gain of 0.2%. 10-year yield 2.32%. Gold unchanged at 1209 the ounce. And crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, up 22 cents a barrel to 48.44. That is a gain of 0.4%. I'm Charlie Pellett. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much. You're listening to Bloomberg Markets. Carol Masser along with Corey Johnson. It is 11:48 in the Bay Area and 2:48 on Wall Street.
The following is from Bloomberg View. Opinions and commentary from Bloomberg columnists.
I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Since February 2010, when employment hit its recessionary low in the U.S., the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area has added 661,000 jobs. That's more than all but four states have added over that stretch. It also represents the fastest rate of job growth of any of the country's 15 biggest metropolitan areas. Dallas-Fort Worth is the country's fourth most populous metro area, but by just about any measure, it has been the economic superstar of the current expansion. One rival, Houston, has slumped lately as the energy business has struggled. And while the San Francisco Bay Area has been even better than Dallas at creating high-paying jobs, it's been terrible at building enough housing for workers to live in. As a result, the median home costs $835,000 in the San Francisco area. In metropolitan San Jose, it's a cool million. In Dallas, $230,000. Cheap real estate and low taxes helped get Dallas's boom started. Now it seems to have reached the point where companies and people move there in large part because other companies and people are moving there. And while all economic miracles eventually come to an end, or at least tarnish, it's still remarkable to watch this one unfold. I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com. or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
This has been Bloomberg View.
And Bloomberg View commentaries can be heard every weekday at this time, also at 5:48 a.m., 8:48 a.m., and 11:48 a.m. Wall Street time right here on Bloomberg Radio.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare man. I breathe the mountains.
Got to give Johnny Cash his minute there. But yes, been everywhere. Look, when it comes to investing everywhere,
he has been traveling
at all
a
the
lot.
Markets. Yeah, well, me too, a little bit. Yakov Arnapolin joins us right now, portfolio manager at PIMCO. And Yakov, when we look at emerging markets, we see a tremendous divergence from what's happened to the rest of the market. If I look at the EEM, the iShares Emerging Market ETF, down 4.8% since the day before the election, we've got the S&P up 3.82%. So a substantial difference there, a difference of 8%. Has anything fundamentally changed? I mean, how do you expect this to play out?
Well, first of all, Corey, Carol, thanks for having me. I haven't been introduced with Johnny Cash before, so that's good.
It's a first for everything.
First for everything. So speaking of emerging markets, obviously I think it's post-election. There's a lot of differentiation in terms of which countries, which regions stand to benefit or at least are insulated enough from potential protectionist policies coming out of the U.S. and those that may be harder hit. And I think if you look at EM equities, there tends to be a fair amount of concentration in Asia. So China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea, countries that tend to be quite open economies, reliant on exports to the U.S. And if we look around the world, I'd say that's the part of the world we're most concerned with. Should we see a kind of more anti-globalization, more protectionist policies, more, you could even say, mercantilist policies coming out of the future administration?
Some of Asia developing Asia.
Yeah, and you could say they're stuck between the rock and the hard place. Why do I say that? On the one hand, we've been quite bearish on China, anticipate further slowdown. And if you look at places such as Korea, such as Taiwan, Korea, for example, exports to China are about 10% of GDP. For Taiwan, that number is 15% of GDP. So as China slows down, they can't really, previously could say, well, the U.S. is growing, but depending on what happens next year, you know, we anticipate trade will continue to kind of taper off. And as a result, you know, for those countries, U.S. exports to GDP another 5-6%. So that's why I say between the rock and the hard place, because you kind of have nowhere to turn anymore.
Does the role of China or does the role of any country emerge with the absence of sort of U.S. leadership in global trade, particularly in Asia? Does another country emerge as more powerful and more influential and thereby gain some investing advantage?
You know, I think that there are two ways of looking at it. One, with regards to kind of from the investment standpoint, which countries, as I mentioned, are the most insulated ones or insular ones that are not as reliant on trade with the U.S., and places like Brazil, India, Argentina come to mind. The second angle is maybe geopolitically, and I think everyone's talking about the potential for Russia with the higher probability of sanctions getting lifted. And just anecdotally, in the post-elections, Russian social media is aflutter with you know, hashtags that say Trump is ours, right? So it just kind of gives you a sense what the mood is like in the country. And I think it's fair that there's probably higher likelihood of sanctions being lifted by the U.S., by Europe. You know, we'll see exactly what that means for the Russian economy, but net-net, it's a positive change.
You've been traveling. You've been to Brazil. You went to Brazil before the elections. You went to the Middle East after the elections. What seems to be or what will be the biggest stories for these areas, these developing areas? And I ask you, Yaakov, in terms of, is it going to be Trump and the administration, their policies? Is it going to be just the fundamentals of those particular right. regions? Is it going to be global growth? I mean, is there something you can kind of wrap your hands all around, or does it just go back to developing markets or developing markets, and you got to really kind of drill down on what's going on in those specific markets?
I'd say it's all of the above. Keep in mind, you know, what is less of a concern to us? One is we lived through the taper tantrum 3 years ago.
Right.
So rates went up back then, U.S. rates went up back then, rates are going now higher again. Now, whether it's taper tantrum or the so-called Trump tantrum, the point is there's a playbook in emerging markets for higher rates. We've lived through it. We've seen it. There's a playbook in emerging markets for weaker commodities, right? So oil has been perking up. It's in the high 40s. We anticipate it's going to kind of gradually grind up over the next 12 months. But even if that proves not to be the case and oil drops, again, we've seen oil in the 30s. So EM countries have lived through that. So I think it's a matter of everyone's waiting for the dust to settle in terms of actual policies, you know, personnel appointments, first 100 days, and specifically what is that going to mean for trade policy, because that's going to be very influential. That's one. Second is, we spoke about China already, that to us remains very influential with regards to emerging markets and the path of these economies. But, you know, I think it's one of these situations where when I hear my U.S. colleagues talk about U.S. assets, be it fixed income or equities, we always talk about late cycle. When we talk about emerging markets, we talk about late crisis, right? So the eye of the storm is behind us. It feels like we've already seen this pretty material currency depreciation. And now we're watching countries. We've seen a pretty positive political wave in LATAM. And I'd say just as we're more concerned and more bearish on Southeast Asia and Asia as a whole post-elections, we're much more constructive and bullish on LATAM. Why? We've had this FX adjustment, the currency adjustment. Now we had the political adjustment in places like Peru, places like Argentina, places like Brazil. And now we're seeing a fiscal adjustment in Colombia, in Mexico. I
love your phrase, political adjustment.
Well, yeah, you could say that the pendulum has certainly swung from more populist governments to kind of more center-right governments, and we anticipate more, you know, orthodox policies. Unfortunately, still Venezuela is an exception to that.
Got a favorite market?
Yeah, you know, favorite market. I'd say it's still LATAM. Brazil certainly remains one of the favorites. You know, keep in mind it's.
Is that about growth or is it about valuation? Like things are so cheap right now, or it's about you see growth coming back?
You know, we like places where we're seeing a virtuous circle, and what I mean by that, we're seeing fiscal adjustment. Growth is still pretty disappointing. We're due to see contraction about 3.5% next year. That should perk up next year, let's say 1-1.5% higher thereafter. But what's important is, as you know, growth is still contracting, we anticipate inflation will go down, leaves the door open for further rate cuts. And ultimately, we think that's going to stimulate the economy, right? So it's kind of it's a country entering a virtuous cycle post post-impeachment, you know, with a new government.
But it's still anemic growth. Just going to Corey's point, I mean, and, you know, certain asset classes certainly have been beaten up big time. So it is a kind of more of a valuation play at this point, with maybe things getting a little bit better, but not great.
I think you raise a great point in that, you know, we are focused on fixed income. Right? Yeah. And I think it's important for people to remember that you don't need blockbuster growth for bonds to do well, right? You kind of, if it's a anemic growth, probably opens the room for more rate cuts, which should do, you know, be actually beneficial for, you know, obviously for local bonds. And also, if we talk about valuations, and just looking at, let's say, the EM sovereign index, compare that to U.S. investment grade, U.S. high yield, just very simplistically looking at the past 10 years, the average spread on EM sovereigns about 40 basis points higher than the past 10 year, the average of the past 10 years. Again, very simplistically, just taking the index. Now, compare that to USIG, where current spread's about 40, 50 inside of the 10-year average. US high yield is over 100 basis points inside of the 10-year average. So, you know, EM has repriced and hasn't come in as much as other fixed income markets.
Right.
And I think even after post-Trump, people are asking us, people are looking for entry points into the sector.
Interesting stuff. Great stuff to chew on there. Really appreciate it. Yakov Armopolin, portfolio manager at PIMCO. You are listening to Bloomberg Markets on Bloomberg Radio with Corey Johnson at Corey TV on the Twitter. She's at Carol Masser on Twitter. This is Bloomberg.